Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. It's been 60 years since the historic U.S. Supreme Court decision, Brown v. Board of Education, which sort of ended segregation. It took many years after that, actually, to close segregated schools, and then there was forced busing. And now we still have pockets of poverty that create de facto segregation. Recent decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court have weakened the practice of race-based college admissions, which many call affirmative action. So what are we going to do now? The book Place Not Race is a new vision of opportunity in America. It argues to look beyond skin color and racial identity, to look at neighborhoods and regions, to compensate for the inequality that we have in America. And you're invited to join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 614-8980. Is it time to stop talking about race in America? Maybe we should talk about class, and what does that mean? And we're joined by the author of the book, Place Not Race, Cheryl Cashin. She's a professor of law at Georgetown University. Cheryl, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
So Cheryl, why did you write this book, Place Not Race?
Well, first of all, let me make it clear. I actually support affirmative action. I just think we can make it better and fairer and to enhance the possibility of helping people who are actually disadvantaged by where they live. And frankly, I think the race-based affirmative action is unnecessarily divisive, and I prefer strategies that encourage rather than discourage cross-racial alliances. And looking at the research from the 8 states that have had affirmative action bans, there are schools that have gotten pretty close to the numbers that they had with using race-based affirmative action in terms of diversity. And I think if you can get pretty close to where you were without using race, you should. And meanwhile, you should do it in a way that helps people who are actually disadvantaged. Only 42% of Americans today of all colors live in a middle-class neighborhood. And that's because increasingly people who are advantaged, people who are highly educated, are segregated into their own communities with highly resourced schools, and the kids of all colors who are outside those very advantaged neighborhoods and jurisdictions get a very different deal.
So this is about fairness?
Absolutely. It's about fairness. It's about promoting diversity in a way that's fair and more politically viable and legally viable. You mentioned in the intro, we just had the 60th anniversary of Brown v. Board. And until we have a society that is willing to invest in K-12 education in a way where we have universal access to highly selective, excellent schooling, I think universities have an ethical obligation to consider the serious unfairness that's out there. You know, a kid can be the valedictorian of their school, but if they're from a low-opportunity, under-resourced school, they may have no AP classes and competing with kids from highly resourced schools that have 20 AP classes. And for a high-achieving student that works hard, takes the hardest classes available to them, and is striving, I think they need and deserve a leg up in admissions because of the structural disadvantages they have to overcome. I don't think you need or deserve a leg up in admissions just because you have black or brown skin. Race in American society is no longer a definitive marker of who is disadvantaged or who is excluded, but meanwhile, place increasingly determines what kind of opportunities you have access to.
We seem to have had this fill-in-the-bubble view of race in America. You color in where you are, and that's, I guess, what opportunities are available to you under affirmative action without really looking at the big picture. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear.
You know, there's been this fill in the bubble. You color in where you are on the SAT list. What is your racial identity, and that uh-huh. would kind of help define where you would qualify for. If there was affirmative action opportunity without looking at the bigger picture that you actually came from a very poor neighborhood or if you came from an affluent neighborhood, that should be part of the calculus.
Right. That's what I'm arguing, you know, and I want to make it clear to your listeners. I mean, I say this in the epilogue to my book. I write a letter to my sons. I'm writing a book that undermines the possibility that they will ever benefit from affirmative action. I have two African-American boys, and that they will ever benefit from having a legacy preference. But I'm okay with that because, you know, they're extremely privileged. They have two parents with 6 degrees between them who've paid attention to every cognitive function. They have two tutors. They're in a highly resourced school. They're going to be fine as long as they take advantage of the resources they have and work hard. But there are kids out there, thousands of kids every year, who work very, very hard but are in under-resourced situations. And I think those are the kids that need and deserve special consideration. And I argue for a range of reforms that make the admissions process more fair. SAT scores should be optional. The financial aid should return to being based on need, not merit. Legacy preferences should be scrapped. The admissions process should focus on those factors which research shows reliably predict success, and standardized tests don't do that. The number one predictor of your likely success in college is your cumulative high school GPA. And your willingness to do the work, your grit, your stick-to-itness, your willingness to be in the library 6 hours a day or however many hours it takes. And, I want to compliment Texas for its top 10. It used to be top 10%, I gather. It's now the top 7% plan. But that plan, which guarantees access to the UT system for kids at the top of their class, does open up opportunity. It is more fair because it gives opportunity to everyone, regardless of the quality of school they're at, as long as they're willing to really strive and do the very best they can.
So the phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. What do you think ought to happen, how to change affirmative action, evolve it? Give us a call. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org. And we're talking with Cheryl Cashin. She is a professor of law at Georgetown University, and she's written the book Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. And so real quickly, because we're going to go to break really, really quickly, but so why dump the SAT? Why not use the SAT?
I said it should be optional. Hundreds of colleges actually have decided to make it optional. Main reason is the SAT score predicts mostly the income of the parents of the kids who took the test. If your parent can afford to spend $6,000 for a private tutor, you can substantially raise your score.
Okay.
And that's not fair.
All right. That's what we're talking about, fairness. Fairness is a core American value. We're going to talk more about that when we come back. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. We're talking about the book Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America, written by Cheryl Cashin. She is a professor of law at Georgetown University. And we're talking about the possible future of affirmative action in college admissions and other things. Let's get Mark on the line. Mark's called in, and the number is 210-614-8980 if you want to call in. Mark, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just want to say that it has occurred to me that your guest is addressing a very small fraction of the students that affirmative action is intended to assist. And she's talking about how numbers are close or very vague. I just cannot, for the life of me, believe that someone would actually believe that affirmative action is not still necessary in this world. It's just...
Okay, we lost Mark. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened there. So, Cheryl, he says affirmative action still needed, I guess, race-based affirmative action.
Well, I agree that affirmative action is still needed, but there's a real irony with race-based affirmative action. You can look out in elite higher education, and that's where it most matters. In non-selective institutions, you automatically get a lot of diversity without affirmative action. But in elite higher education, you can look out in classrooms and often see what I call optical diversity. But below the surface, there's not that much difference in the backgrounds of the kids. And ironically, for advocates of race-based affirmative action, often it's redounding to the benefit of very advantaged immigrant kids, often Africans, who don't come out of the legacy that affirmative action was meant to address, this legacy of racial discrimination and Jim Crow segregation. So I'm arguing that place-based affirmative action might actually help more of the kinds of kids that people who support affirmative action have in mind, and meanwhile do it in a way where you get less resentment and possibly more political support. This is a strategy that is under attack. It's under attack in the courts, and the Supreme Court said 2 weeks ago that if a majority of voters in a state like Michigan want to ban the policy, they can. And in opinion polls, the majority of people say that they do not support consideration of race in admissions in higher education. So as a person who cares about diversity, I'm advocating place and other reforms as a way to pursue diversity in a way that's politically viable and legally viable.
In response to that decision, the Michigan College admissions case, Sonia Sotomayor in the minority said that we cannot wish away racial inequality, that it still exists.
I don't disagree with the idea that racial inequality exists, but my point is that how are you going to create a majority in a political context to support strategies that attack the underlying systems that create inequality? And I also, in this book, underscore that, yes, there's racial inequality, but there's a lot of economic inequality out there as well. There are a lot of struggling white people. Poverty is growing fastest in the suburbs, and I think progressives, like your caller, who care about racial justice, racial inequality, and inequality generally, need to be about the business of building alliances between struggling whites and people of color that are both experiencing inequality, and, you know, to advocate for strategies that bring all kids along.
Okay, let's get another caller on the air, and our number is 210-614-8980 if you want to join the conversation. Bill has called in. Bill, you're on the air. Welcome to The Source.
Yes, hello.
Hey there.
Hey, my name's Bill. My wife and I are in our 60s and working. We put both of our children through college. We really did not get any kind of special consideration for admissions. We live in Texas, South Texas, and I believe that the system is very dated. And if you take a look at the demographics of South Texas, I guess you might consider a middle-class individual. I'm a disabled vet. My kids didn't get any money or any special consideration on admissions for South Texas. But yet, when you stop and think about it, demographically speaking, I'm now a minority in South Texas. There are more Hispanics in South Texas than there are whites. Now, that's not to say anything against Hispanics. I mean, I like Hispanic people.
Right. So, Bill, can you get to the point?
The point is the system for admissions is outdated. Affirmative action should not be a consideration for admissions into schools, for colleges.
Okay, let's let Cheryl respond to that. But thanks for calling in, Bill. Appreciate your call, Cheryl. What do you think about Bill's points?
So Bill's point, a lot of people feel the way Bill does, and particularly a lot of white people, and that is the reality in terms of race-based affirmative action. And I think I'm in agreement with him to a degree. I'm arguing that race should no longer be a consideration in admissions. However, in a society where there is a great deal of inequality and disadvantage, if you can't afford to buy your way into what I call a gold standard neighborhood that has terrific K through 12 schools that sets you up really well to compete and get access to selective higher education, and only a minority of people in American society get in those neighborhoods, then you get a very different deal. And I'm saying, regardless of your race, if you are a high-achieving kid who works hard, whether you're from South Texas or San Antonio or some other environment, regardless of your color, if you've had to overcome serious structural disadvantages or you come from a family of low wealth, I think that is a consideration that should factor in. I'm not saying you automatically should be entitled. In the same way, I don't think being a legacy kid automatically entitles you, or your race should automatically entitle you. But I think universities have an ethical obligation to help mitigate the structural barriers that are out there. Otherwise, what we'll have is a society where increasingly only the already advantaged have access. And by the way, the University of Texas system, public school, is subsidized by all taxpayers. So, you know, I think all taxpayers should have a fair shot, if they're hardworking, at accessing these institutions.
So you say fair. Let's go back to the issue of fairness. It's the fairness of what? That any kid that has the ability, the brain power, the brain wattage, that there shouldn't be these obstacles to opportunity for them, whether they, where they grew up in the Rio Grande Valley or the west side of San Antonio or the east side or wherever, mm-hmm. they should be able to have a shot at it.
Yeah, let me make it a little plainer, right? You might be the valedictorian of your high school, and you name some places. I'm not as familiar with Texas, obviously, as you is. But let's say from the Rio Grande Valley, or was it South Texas that Bill
sure.
was from? You might be the valedictorian of your school, but be at a school that has zero or only one or two AP classes, and you are competing with kids who are in schools that may have 20 AP classes. It's much harder to develop a high school career that has this sort of kinds of marks of distinction that admissions officers at fancy schools look to if you come from a disadvantaged school. But if you're a hardworking kid and you're at the top of your class, I think, you know, whether you or not you have a fair to middling SAT score, I think that's the kind of factor that you should, the admissions officer, take into account. I'm not saying you should. None of these places in college belong to anyone.
Sure.
No one's entitled to them. But I think kids who come from disadvantaged settings but have managed to achieve despite them, that's something that deserves some special consideration when they're competing head-to-head with
right.
very privileged kids who have a lot of resources available to them.
Okay, let's get another caller on the air very fast. Denise has called in. Denise, welcome to The Source. We're short on time, but go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I'll make this very quick. Dr. Cashin, I just wanted to commend you on your idea. I think I'm a black female, college educated, And when you started talking, I was struck at really basically it sounds like a no-brainer to me. It certainly makes a tremendous sense that that people should be admitted based on need and accomplishment, irregardless of race. And I guess my it makes just complete sense to me. And I guess my question to you is, if you've had an opportunity to, I suppose, proffer this idea with admissions communities and colleges, and to what extent that that you've been able to do that, and also what the response generally is.
Okay, Denise, thanks for your comments. So, Cheryl, are you getting traction on this?
Well, you know, a lot of people are buying the book, and I'm getting emails from people around who it seems to resonate with. Do I get some pushback? Yes, I do. But I just feel like we're so broken in our politics and where we are now that we need some fresh thinking that helps unite people rather than divide them,
right,
and expands opportunity.
Cheryl Cashin, she is a professor of law at Georgetown University, wrote the book Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. Cheryl, thank you for joining us. This is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.